What's up, my friends? Kyle Tierman here, and this episode of the podcast is with David Satori. David Satori is one of the Beats Antique Trio and co-creator of the band Dirtwire. Born in Burlington, Vermont, David was inspired by the rich local music scene and started playing guitar and drums at the age of 13. David produced his first original album with his band Bubble Tribe in 1997 as a senior in high school and went on to study music at Cal Arts in Los Angeles, graduating with a bachelor's degree in composition and performance in 2001. After college, David bought an aging airport bus shuttle, converted it to run on vegetable oil, and toured the U.S. with his band The Funnies, a four-piece space funk band, and Aphrodisia, a female-fronted futuristic Afrobeat big band from San Francisco. David also co-founded and produced events with the Sustainable Living Roadshow, a traveling eco-festival. In 2006, David helped organize a month-long West African tour with Aphrodisia and the African Showboys from Ghana, which culminated in two nights at the legendary Shrine in Lagos, Nigeria, the musical home of Femi Kuti, son of Fela Kuti. After returning from West Africa, David committed to recording with Beats Antique, a trio born in the San Francisco performance underground, Burning Man, and West Coast-based music scenes. Beats Antique soon became an international touring production and has released over 10 albums in 12 years, all written and produced by the band. On a parallel track to Beats Antique, David pursued a recording project with his longtime bandmate and friend Evan Fraser, which evolved into Dirtwire, a trio with the addition of Mark Reveille that tours internationally and has released 9 albums. I'm a really big fan of this guy. I've been a fan of his music for a long time, and it was very cool to be able to sit down with him. Big thank you to our longtime sponsor, RPM Training. RPM Training makes functional fitness gear, and you can use the code in the description below, Kyle T-Man, to get 10% off all functional fitness gear from RPM. If you're going to get yourself some workout gear, get it from RPM by supporting them. You're supporting this podcast. And thank you also to Santa Cruz Medicinals. Santa Cruz Medicinals makes potent CBD. I have some of their CBD coconut oil right above my bed right now, and you can use the code Kyle10 for 10% off all Santa Cruz Medicinal CBD. If you're going to get CBD, get it from these guys. And without further ado, please welcome to the show. I'm not re-recording this intro. Sorry, guys. Without further ado, please welcome to the show, David Satori from Beats Antique and Dirtwire.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
Nice, man. Well, let's start off where we were just talking, which is on minimal recording setups, which I'm a fan of. Yeah. My dad is actually a filmmaker, and he always drummed it into me. It's not about the camera; it's about the story. And I was wondering if you could just start by telling me a bit about the work you're doing to get some of these micro recording studios to people who otherwise wouldn't have access.
Yeah, totally. I'm very fascinated with what we can do with the technology that we already have. Like our phones, for instance, are so powerful. Like people are making albums on there with certain apps now, like even GarageBand, which comes with most iPhones. You could literally produce a full track and get it going. And encouraging, kids to get creative with, a lot of kids have these smartphones now. So, but yeah, there's a project called Sunrise Studios Collective, and it was launched this past year over COVID, and we have we got some funding, and we've built a recording studio in Kenya in a refugee camp called Kakuma. Full building, full equipment, and solar powered. We got a solar powered donation by a great a company named Powered by Light. So there, that's been huge to see that happen. And then just like see the reaction that the community had to it. And that's just one level of it. Like really we're, you know, like this little Zoom recording and a camera like that, trying to get those to certain communities. You know, we don't need to build a building, but we can just drop off these little media packages.
Totally. It doesn't take much. And you get something, you know, recording with an H6N recorder and a little Handycam mic right there. And I always find that, you know, it doesn't take much technology to introduce someone to a totally different aspect of themselves, right? Like all of a sudden, hey, I have a mic, I'm an interviewer. Wait, oh, I get to play the interviewer version of myself. And I think about, you know, a kid in this Kenyan refugee camp who maybe has some musical talent, and all it takes is that little piece of technology to allow he or she to really practicing to inhabit a whole new version of yourself.
Yeah, and amplify their songs, their stories, whatever they want to share. So it's like, yeah, we're not coming in with any agenda as opposed to just help tell stories and help make music and art. So it's exciting to see what's coming out of it and some of the stuff they're producing. And so we're just getting that going, and there's going to be a label behind it and a, you know, a whole thing. We're going to be releasing like a series each, you know, probably quarterly, every 3 months or something. It's all starting though, so excited to share it. And
so what is a recording studio look like, or a micro recording studio that you might bring into a refugee camp?
It's super, super simple. Like it's a desk, a laptop, a good microphone, a sound card, speakers, and that's like really it. I mean, and then maybe like a keyboard, like a MIDI keyboard, and then software for the computer. It's really simple now. Like you don't need anything fancy. You don't need outboard gear. You don't need the fancy stuff to get really high quality audio and video. So we're like hooking up some cameras as well to document some filmmaking. But yeah, it's just beginning, and we're trying to keep it really simple. And this is a really good example. I'm just inspired to see your setup because I'm like, oh yeah, these are little setups that we can ship out and like get them out there. And so, yeah, we'll see. Like, you never know. You might send out 10 of them and maybe like 6 of them will be used, but it's worth that, you know, spread. Right.
So where, remind me the name of this project again.
Yeah, it's called Sunrise Studio Collective. And we're trying to create a collective because we want to like bring people who are making media from all around the world together. And we're working on a map that's going to really link everybody. And there'll be different initiatives like songs or remixes or, you know, a thematic idea for a song that people can do in collaborations. And this is all where stuff we're working on. But we've started the first studio, and the website is SRS Studios. So srstudios.org.
Okay.
Find more info and get involved.
So let's say I'm a Kenyan refugee, and you know, I'm in this camp. What would a studio recording session look like? How do you bring me into what that world could look like?
I mean, it's the same as anything. Same like, well, it's just what they're making songs for people there that want to make songs. There's NGOs that are looking for content in the refugee camp that are coming in. Organizations that are looking for media that I think that are hitting them up right now. And we're just learning all these different, once you build a hub like this, this is a massive hub in their community. This, even just having the solar panels there is massive. So it's like, we're just learning about how that affects the community and what new relationships that's going to do and opportunities it's going to bring for them. So it's a big learning experience on our end on like supplying these kind of experiences and opportunity.
Yeah. What influence has African music had in your life?
Massive, yeah. I'm a huge Africa diaspora, like the whole continent. I'm a lover of all the musics from South Africa, from Zimbabwe, the Shona music, the Imbira music, which I've studied, to like West African drumming, Ewe culture, which I got to study with going to school at CalArts outside LA. to like desert blues in Mali, which I've gotten to travel to and like sit down and like play with some you know, Vu Farkatori, who's Ali Farkatori's son, who's keeping the tradition going, an amazing man and musician, recorded with him.
Who's Ali Ali
Farkatori.
Ali Farkatori.
Yeah, he's sort of like one of the godfathers of like desert blues from Mali. And he got popular by Ry Cooder recorded with him. Ry Cooder is a producer, an amazing American musician who produced Buena Vista Social Club and brought, you know, that old school Cuban music back to the light, and it was a huge album. And so his work in Mali really sort of brought light to Ali Farkatori, who's, you know, a legend and has been a legend over there for so long. But his work, Ry Cooder's work with him, like really brought it to the main stage. And so my mom played it. Like, that's how I heard about it. When I was like 12, she was playing Ry Cooder's album with Ali Farkatori, and I heard it and I was like, what is this, you know? And it changed my perspective, you know?
What does Mali blues sound like?
Oh, wow. I mean, a lot of people feel like it's the it's where the blues came from. I mean,
really?
Like when the slave trade was happening, a lot of people were unfortunately taken from there, you know? But that's when you listen to blues, deep southern blues music, in this, you know, in the deltas down in the south, it's very, very similar to the scales and the way it was played when you listen to the music from Mali in the desert. So there's a very easy like correlation. You just hear it.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's that connection, definitely. I mean, that's
okay.
where it originated, or one of the places it originated. Yeah.
Right. So, you've done quite a bit of traveling in Africa. Before we were recording, you were telling me about trips you've taken to Ghana.
Yeah.
And you'll there are instruments in this house that are, you know, come from Ghana.
Yeah,
and other
Awe drums here. Yeah.
So, you know, if you get inspired by something in your travels and you'll bring it back into your own band, like, will you bring those instruments back and then you'll just start messing around with them? Like, I'm really interested in all of the kind of remixing that you do between cultures to create a unique sound.
Yeah. I mean, for me, there's this crazy story. When I was in Mali, there was this guy who played a tomato can. It was a tomato can with a wire, and he played it with a stick. And it's like actually how they do some of this traditional, what you would call a fiddle, like African fiddle music there. And it was like, wow, that's the roots right there. Just a can and a wire and a stick. And it was like some of the wildest sounds I've ever heard. Because they send it through distortion, they send it through amps, and it was just like some of the gnarliest, wild, heaviest sounds I've heard. So he sold it to me. So I have this tomato can, and I'm about to put these recordings out. I haven't put them out. I recorded like 4 years ago, and I've just been sort of sitting on it. So I'm excited to release those recordings. I'm not less necessarily trying to play that instrument live. I'm taking the influence that it's had on me as an artist, and I sort of translate it to the instruments I play. So for me, like that tomato can violin, I'll try to play that on. I'll bow the banjo, which is a unique style, but I can get that sound that's close to it, and so I'll do some of the ways he plays on it on the instruments I play, as opposed to like try to like play all of these different traditional instruments, you know. But that's how I do it.
Will you take recordings when you're traveling and then play those back when you're recording yourself?
Yeah, no, I did a lot of recording when I was in Mali, and I have totally listened to them, and they've influenced what I'm doing. And yeah, no, that's one of the best ways to learn. It's just record and then listen, and like, yeah, that's right. It's repetition.
So I had a question for you here that it might fall flat, but I'll ask it anyway. When you think of the banjo, who comes to mind?
Well, straight off the bat, Bela Fleck, because I grew up going to see Bela Fleck and the Flecktones in Vermont when I was growing up as a teenager and getting into seeing live music. Fish, I mean, Fish doesn't play banjo that much. They play a little on their recordings, but Fish was a big influence from Vermont, growing up in Vermont. But Bela Fleck was, you know, we'd go see him like at least once a year when he would come through, and he was really pushing. He is like always pushing banjo to like new places, and just like how he approached it with his jazz and the futuristic, like Future Man, he plays the drum machine, and Victor Wooten, an amazing bass player. So they're always experimenting with fusions, and so that really influenced me. And then the first band I was in Burlington in high school, I played drum set, and the main lead instrument was electric banjo. My buddy Charles Butler and my other friend Seth Whittier played bass. So we were a trio. I played drums, and so I was in a band with an electric banjo playing psychedelic, crazy, like wild music when I was in high school, and we were just obsessed with that kind of stuff. So yeah, I was just loving the banjo from an early age.
You grew up in Burlington, Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was the music scene like growing up there?
Oh man, it was so good. Like it was great. I mean, I got to see Fish blow up. Like it was like, you know, 93, 94. It was right when Fish was starting to play bigger.
Is that where they're from?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
They're from Vermont, and they live all over Vermont, I think, but they, you know, they were in Burlington for a long time. And getting to see them do their thing and the community around that and the musical community. They were in these offshoot bands. Like Trey was in a band with this guy named Jamie Macefield, who is an amazing local mandolin player.
Who's Trey?
Trey's a guitar player for Fish. Trey Anastasio. And they'd have this band called the Jazz Mandolin Project. And they had another band called Bad Hat. And they would just do these small shows, and I would go see them when I was in high school in like these little like cafes. This place called the Last Elm Cafe in Burlington, where we would play a lot, and they would play there. And it was just like such a fun, small community of musicians that if you just knew where to go, you could see these like these dudes that were sort of legends in town. So yeah, it was a special time, you know, before the internet and stuff too. So you just had to know and find out.
Right, right. Well, the internet. Fish is an interesting example of a band that's really developed a cult following. And I mean, you know probably more about this than I do, but like, they don't play the same show twice or something like that, or like, what is it? Do you think about Fish that has led to that like kind of rabid cult following?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with improvisation, like changing, like they're just constantly taking the audience on a journey, and you know, not doing the same thing. Like, it's people are like, I see something different every time I go, and they're taking chances, you know, they're like fully like making music in the moment, which is full musical improvisation, you know, and that's exciting for the audience. And that's, you know, that's where the Grateful Dead, they're carrying on a tradition from the Grateful Dead. They're carrying on a tradition from jazz. I mean, that's what jazz is doing, you know, it's like this full freedom improvisation. So I'm excited to get back into that. Like I found that some of the stuff, when playing with electronics, it's harder to do that. It's harder to do that when you're playing with beats, because it's like there's more structure there. It's not as malleable, not as responsive, right?
Right.
As opposed to a drummer. So I'm excited to like go back into that direction and do more improvisation. Yeah.
When you go out for a show, will you have prepped the set in advance? Like, you know what song is coming after the next one? What does that whole setup look like?
Yeah, totally. We prepare a whole set, like get it all dialed. I'm taking a break from being on the road. I'm actually stepping back from touring with Dirtwire and Beats Antique. I'm doing some touring with Beats Antique this summer, but I've decided that I just want to like step off the road for a while, you know, COVID gave me this whole perspective. So, I mean, I've been doing shows for 20 years and stuff with different bands, and yeah, no, we prepare the set, you know, we kept put it together, and like, it's, you know what you're doing when you go out.
And will it usually be a will there be conversations about, okay, we want to lead the audience through some kind of story, or like we want to start with this song because it's going to bring this kind of mood in, or finish with that one? Like, are there any kind of conversations about the arc that you're going to lead the audience through, or is it more just random song by song?
No, definitely. We're always like, it's a full, like, thought out architecture of like, let's start here, let's build it here, let's bring it down here, let's ramp up towards the end, get the energy like more exciting at the end. And definitely. Yeah, like it's very thought out. And then we're trying to navigate a lot of different elements, like with Beats Antique, like Zoe's performing. So there's a dance element. And so how many times is she dancing? So it's like this giant equation.
Who's Zoe for people?
Zoe is the dancer in Beats Antique and producer, a member of Beats Antique. But her dancing like influences the set. Like we have to be like, how is that going to work? And with Dirtwire, it's like what instruments are we changing, and like how does that feel? And like, so it's a very it becomes a very complex
equation,
yeah, of like how you lay it out with smooth transitions. And yeah, it can be complicated, yeah,
but I would imagine
when it works, you're like, oh, okay, this is working, this is great.
Okay. Is there a song that you'll like that is your ramp up song where you're like, this one's gonna make the audience typically do this?
Yeah, totally. There's a like a lot of songs where you like, where you like do halftime, it's like doon doon ka doon 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 ka, and then doon doon ka doon doon ka, you just sort of change it up like double time. And like those kind of songs really help like get the energy moving faster. And yeah, it's like these rhythmic transitions or a speed up, like a song with a good speed up or ramp. So yeah, you look for those songs. And yeah, it's a whole giant math problem.
So I've been to a number of your shows, and you have quite a stage presence. Is that something that you, I guess, how did you develop that stage presence?
I don't know. I think I just many, many years of performing, like just being on stage, it feels really natural to just be there and do that. Ironic, I'm taking a break from it, but you know, I don't think I'm fully done. I just need to have perspective on it and see how I want to have balance it in my life. But I don't know. I think it's a thing I had when I was a kid too. I was like performing for my mom, so okay. It's like it's an energetic thing.
Ever have any kind of like warm up or ritual to get yourself into that state of going out to, you know, let's take like Red Rocks, for example. You've told me that's a really special place. Like getting to headline Red Rocks for Beats Antique was a really special performance for you because it's a special venue.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'll do before you go out on stage to psych yourself up or calm yourself down?
For me, warming up, like just having the instrument in my hands is like, makes me feel calmer. Cause like, then I feel like, okay, my fingers are warmed up. Not thinking about it too much, like talking with people or friends or like they're backstage. That's actually what helps me more, is like, not thinking about it. Because especially on a massive show like that, I'm like, hey, how you doing, how you been? And I'm just like, cool, I can lock in with this person. I don't like, sometimes I'll take a nap or meditate a little. That's helped, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, what is Red Rocks? I've been there before and it's a super cool spot.
Oh, Red Rocks is a beautiful natural amphitheater in outside of Denver, Colorado, and outside Boulder. And it's it's just this natural amphitheater that they built. They built, you know, a stage out of, and it's epic. It's been there since almost 100 years or over 100 years. It's been there forever. But they've turned it into a event space, and it's gorgeous. I mean, when I was a kid, I saw U2 live at Red Rocks. It was like a tape I owned. I'd be like, wow, what is this place? This is so cool. And they had a photo of it on the, it was a trip to finally play there after like see, like, having that tape as like a 10-year-old or something.
Over the course of the pandemic, I got this old 97 Ford RV and took a big road trip through Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. And one morning, I'd never been there. And someone was like, you got to check out Red Rock. So I took my RV there at like 4 a.m. Yeah. And then got a bunch of blankets and walked out to the amphitheater and just watched the sunrise. And there was no performing or anything like that, but you just got to see these red rocks illuminated as the sunrise was coming up over Denver. And it's just a special place, man.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. never gotten to see that. That sounds epic. That's full sunrise there.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But you, you've done some van lifing yourself, right?
Oh, yeah. And I've been living in and out of buses for a long time. I got out of college in like 2001 and bought a bus, like an old shuttle bus, and converted it and just sort of lived in that for a couple years.
Yeah. What kind of bus was it?
It was an old, like one of those shuttle buses with the luggage thing in the back. And we ripped out all the seats, you know, like an airport shuttle bus.
Yeah.
And, put some beds in there and like just started touring the band I was in.
Was that the veggie oil bus?
We converted it to veggie oil. Yeah. And that was like early on in the veggie oil converting days, or I guess, I mean, it started in people were doing it in the '70s and stuff, had this resurgence in the early 2000s.
You just smell like French fries everywhere you go.
Yeah. It was a lot of work, but such a cool feeling. And I did that to two or three buses. And when you hit that switch and, you know, you went to the back of the restaurant and you sucked out the veggie oil and, like, you know, the restaurants would give it to us. We just
take it off our hands.
Yeah.
You know, but this is gasoline for us.
Exactly. Well, now they sell it to biodiesel companies. So those days are, like, not over. You know, you can't really do that. I don't think you can find – maybe you can find it somewhere, but it's really hard. But back then, you could totally – she's like, hey, can I get it? And they'd give it to you. You'd suck it out. And then, yeah, we saved a lot of money, you know. I mean, it was a lot of work, but it was fun. It was a great feeling knowing that we were recycling our fuel. Just knowing that there's an alternative, that there's always an alternative. It's like that was really the shift and like really putting off, you know, turning light bulbs off or on in our heads. Just being like, whoa, well, if we like a bunch of like college kids, hippies like coming out of college can figure this out and not be using fossil fuel, what else is there? Like if like the whole industry just sort of like was thinking, and you know, now we're seeing alternatives with electricity and electric cars, and but I think we can go even further. There's something else out there, because you know, all the energy that goes into the batteries and that whole industry.
Yeah,
that just seems
living in a van, you know, for any period of time, it does for me. Like, you know, when I was doing it on the road for a while, and then in all I think it was a year and a half living full time in my RV, and having the chance to wake up and not know what the day was going to hold or where you were going to be that night was so fucking fun. I mean, you just didn't know the people that you were going to run into, the places you were going to go. You have a loose idea, but I mean, one of the highlights for me on that trip was, you know, I was going through Missoula, Montana, and I met this crew of river surfers. There's this underground crew of Missoula river surfers.
I've seen them out on the river, right in the middle of Missoula.
Yeah.
Right near the theater, right?
Yeah. And they shred, and they're full-on surfers. And I, you know, linked up with this crew, and they took me hunting, and we just had a great time. But... and I was traveling alone, you know, so I was just always like looking for new people to hang with, and it just was the best possible dynamic, because it just forced me to get out of my comfort zone in a way that had I been cruising with my friends and staying at a hotel, I wouldn't have nearly the same stories to tell.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, the people you meet on the road and the adventures you get into are... that's what it's all about. I mean, that's what life's all about, is finding those moments. That's so cool. Yeah, yeah. You got to have I've seen them surfing right there, like right in downtown. There's like one of those breaks right there near the bridge. There's a bridge right there, and they just
There's a few spots, and they, you know, the way that we monitor swell and tide, they monitor snow melt.
Right.
Because if it's been, if they have a ton of snow and then there's a hot few days, they know that the river's going to be up, and there's certain spots that get good depending on the level of water.
Right.
And it's fucking gnarly, man. I mean, they'll jump out on the river and it's a standing wave, right? Yeah. So they'll ride the seam of water into what's called a wave train, you know, so where the river walls squeeze together a little bit, and then it creates this standing wave. And they shred, man. I mean, you can do full on turns. But the second you fall, you realize that you're in a sweeping whitewater river
with rocks.
Right, yeah. The they all wear big wave surfing leashes that have a pull away cord. So it's like a little cord that you can pull. It's a pin that detaches you from the leash in case the leash gets wrapped around a rock and they can pull away and swim out there.
That's gnarly.
Dude, yeah. I mean, my buddy Dylan is like, he's such a badass. He'll keep surfing until there's ice sheets coming down the river.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the guys go in there with wetsuits, like, right, full on. Because the best waves are in the spring when it's, like, still cold.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, river culture is amazing. Like, growing up in Santa Cruz, where I was not really into that river culture. But like going through those states, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, the rivers are the centerpiece of the town.
Yeah.
And it's so rad when you can have a town that like that's their feature. And there's, you know, bars and restaurants set up along it. And there's areas where families can take their kids down. It's like it's a whole part of America.
Yeah.
That just has this it's centered around the river.
Yeah, man.
And all the recreation that comes along with it.
Totally. Yeah. It's beautiful to see how Bend, Oregon is really beautiful right around the river.
I haven't been
there.
Yeah. I want to check that out.
It's a good one. Yeah.
So how many, you said that you were living in vans
or buses. Buses. Yeah. Full on buses. Yeah.
While you were touring with your bands?
I mean, while we tour.
While you tour.
Yeah, when Beats Antique was going out, that was our home for many years in our bus, and we owned our buses, so that was like we would go, design interiors and we had these metal workers from Burning Man, and like I had a whole crew of awesome friends like help design our bus and make our home, and yeah, we used that bus for many years, and yeah, it's our home, but I mean we wouldn't live in it. After tour,
yeah,
get out of there as soon as we landed. But yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I mean, are you a big builder as well?
A little. I'm not like too. I mean, I like designing and I like helping like come up with ideas around it. But no, I'm not like the best handyman. I've just been playing music with all my time with my hands and producing. Yeah,
I did an interview with do you know Didi Fleming from Lightning in a Bottle?
I know Didi, yeah.
Yeah,
he's great.
And he was he and his brothers developed Lightning in a Bottle, and he was talking about how his brothers were just that was the way that they thought was just in building.
Oh yeah, those guys are hands on dudes. I mean, I've known them since they really started. I think like the second Lightning in a Bottle they did in Live Oak Canyon, or forget that. Yeah, Live Oak, outside Santa Barbara, many, many years ago. And they would come up with the most creative, interesting designs with like found shit, like pallets was their thing for a long time. Getting these shipping pallets and like creating these wild structures, and they would just do all these different designs with pallets and wood they would find, and
right,
and just like really inventive, really beautiful lighting. You know, his brother Josh is really great at lighting and making that ambiance. Great.
And
team.
You've performed at Lightning in a Bottle quite a few times, right?
Oh yeah, no, that's like it is our home. That's where we came out of. That's like where Beats Antique got our first big show, and you know Jesse Fleming was a big supporter in booking us and putting us in front of people, like, and then bringing us to Coachella at their stage in Coachella, the Dolab stage in Coachella. We would do DJ sets there. They'd bring us there, and then yeah, we've been one of the staples at Lightning in a Bottle, and yeah, it's like your fam. We love those peeps.
So do you? You're just mentioning like that was one of the first places that Beats Antique got mm-hmm. a big audience.
Yeah.
Did you notice a definitive shift from like, okay, we've played at Lightning in a Bottle, this is big. Like I'm interested in those definitive shifts that artists go through where all of a sudden it's like we're going to need a bigger boat moment. Mm. And it seems like that happened with Beats Antique.
Yeah. 2008 was like, we played the main stage. I think it was like on a Sunday. And it was just like the hub of our community, of our like West Coast, like underground, you know, electronic, funky Burning Man community. That was the heart of this party, like Lightning in a Bottle. And all of our friends came out, and it was like a big moment, like, you know, just checking out all of our friends out there and like all the feeling all the support and love. And then from that point on, you know, we started touring more, and then we got, you know, bigger management, and the band started to grow. But, you know, Lightning in a Bottle kept bringing us back, and we've been playing it, like, you know, off and on for, like, almost 15 years now, I guess.
Yeah. What, for people who haven't been, what do you think is unique about Lightning in a Bottle and what they've done there?
They've done an amazing job of curating a beautiful space for the imagination to wander, and for, like, the child within all of us to, like, thrive and play. You know, they have all, I mean, they've really taken the Burning Man interactive elements and brought that to a music festival, which a lot of music festivals haven't done, you know, and are, I think some of them are starting to do that more, you know, but they were the originators of really like fusing Burning Man culture with a music festival. Like, you know, instead of just going to like a stage and then you go to another stage and it's just white tents, and they made it beautiful. Like, it was like beautiful set designs, like really amazing stage designs, and the ambiance, and then like interactive weird little worlds you could go to and hang out and chill, and it's just
and participate
exactly.
Yeah that's I've been there a few times, and I remember going and seeing a guy. Do you know who Super Tall Paul is?
Yeah.
So really. I remember going and seeing like Super Tall Paul. He's this very tall guy who does looping on these like very little stages. Yeah. And it's like, it was almost like a child's playground that you would go in, and just the imagination, as you say, like in the places that they would set up to allow the imagination to wander. Mm. And I guess, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about with the refugees in Kenya, like setting up the container for your imagination to wander and for you to be able to express yourself artistically. And sometimes it just takes that little push.
Yeah.
It just takes that little push to give someone the H6N mic or take them to the stage that they just have never experienced. You know, it's a lot of young people, a lot of like 18, 19 year old kids who have just lived, you know, at home their whole life, and you are blowing open what they think is possible.
Right.
And it really does change people, man. I mean, it changes people massively. Like, I don't think that Mudwater would have nearly the same vibe as it does without Burning Man and without the influence that those festivals had on Shane and, you know, on all of us. Like, it very much is constantly being remixed into what you go forth with in your own project.
Yeah, no, I think it's those friendships and the community that is built out of that, and the collaborative partners you find in these spaces that really shift people's lives, you know? And I feel like that is the hub of like what these transformational festivals are doing, and like Burning Man and Lightning in a Bottle, they're connecting like-minded people to come together to find community, friendship, families, like businesses, and shifting people's lives and guiding them and where they want to go, like-minded people.
Mm.
and that's all we can ask for. Yeah, and facilitating space and opportunity in you know, in Kenya right now with what we're working on is an element of that. And like, it's really, really excited to see where that goes in like 5 years. Right. Just like after going to a festival when you're 18, like 5 years later, how did that affect your life? And what are you doing now? You know?
So speaking of spaces and new and different kind of spaces, tell me about VR and how you think about virtual reality and the role of VR in music and the potential of that moving forward.
Yeah. I think it's Wild West out there. You know, the metaverse is becoming, it's getting explored right now. It's becoming defined or trying to be defined right now. It's going to take a while, I think, for it to really fully take form. But, you know, it's really taking taking information and making it more experiential, you know, like making it way more interactive, which I think is going to turn on a lot of people into learning a different way. I think it's going to really shift a lot of people who don't really learn from like books as well to, you know, experiential learning, which is a whole different side of the brain, which I think is going to help certain people that don't learn traditionally the way we've been trained to learn, right? Like dictated like notes on a chalkboard, right? I think that's just like it's going to look archaic to how we start to, how we're learning in the future.
That's a fucking good example. Yeah. That, I mean, we'll probably look at chalkboard classes like we look at cave paintings now.
Exactly. Yeah. We're gonna be like, what? Like, how did you guys even learn? And then we'll realize that that probably wasn't the most efficient way of learning, but it's what we had at the time. And it that was the chalkboard, right? It's a massive tool at that time to communicate information to these young minds that need to learn. Like, how do you disseminate that information? The same way that you can look at VR. It's going to be a massive tool to create information, and it's going to create all sorts of whatever, entertainment, violence, all of the darkness that you can imagine will happen there. But it's up to you, us, whoever, to create alternatives and light and opportunity and excitement. And so I look at it that way. Like, it's a tool, it's a chalkboard that's like coming. It's not like going away.
The chalkboard is coming.
This is like a very, very interesting looking chalkboard coming at us. And I'm excited to see what we as community are going to write on that chalkboard and do. So I'm exploring in it. I'm working with some really amazing people that are, you know, I had a chance to collaborate with Paul Stamets and Android Jones, or some of my two, you know, favorite people out there that are doing really cool stuff, and made this virtual mushroom for Burning Man when Burning Man went virtual in 2020. And that sort of launched me into this idea of creating worlds in Unreal Engine and working with people and like, what do they want to speak, or like, what do they want to say on these stages, or what stage do you want? Do you want a world? What are you doing here? It's like, it's just a new, it's Wild West, you know? Yeah. What do you want to see there?
Yeah.
It's like, it's really just a question, you know? It's like,
how far can your imagination take
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then how quickly can your, it's so interesting when you think of how the whole world was just created with imagination, right? And it's and then there's just these various mediums, whether it's a physical house or a song or a book, that are putting your imagination, it made manifest.
Yeah.
Right? So it's very important to cultivate a big imagination. It's one of the things in the world that we don't know the limits of. There's seemingly no end to imagination. And it is my belief that it's a muscle that people can cultivate. And, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about Morning Pages and The Artist's Way and these various ways to kickstart creative genius. And I've heard you in interviews talk about how when you have a song or a note come through you, it feels like it's coming through you. Like, you almost can't take full credit for it. It feels like you're a conduit to something outside of yourself that we don't really have the words to explain. But pretty much every creative will attest to this balance between dedicated hard work and just being a frequency that that thing can come through.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, are there things that, that you have found that you can do to strengthen that muscle? You know, your version of morning pages to make sure that you're as tuned in to those frequencies as possible.
Wow. Yeah. That's a good question. I think taking care of yourself, like being healthy, you know, exercising is the key to like create, like, you know, once you have a clean vessel, like the, you know, you can, the messages can come through more. I mean, it's not always true. I mean, the people have done like not taking care of themselves. Yeah. And
there are the Hunter Thompson lots examples, of
and,
but
and then you can those, go that way too.
Those candles burn bright, but quickly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's just, it seems a lot more roller coaster ride, you know, which is interesting. It's just, everybody's got their own path. But for me, I found that like, I mean, psilocybin has been a huge ally in creating, and I've again, more into microdosing, which has helped. But creating space, like creating ritual around creating and creating time for it, putting away that time to like, I'm just going to see what comes out here. Yeah, no, I've found that for my most profound moments with music, it's usually been around psilocybin. And that's when I felt this big channel because, you know, you're in an altered space and you're tapping into things that we don't understand really, and I think we're just starting the conversation around it, which I'm excited to hear people's perspective on as we it becomes less taboo, and that's why we've been talking about it more, because it's like becoming decriminalized, legalized, and it's been part of our path as a dirt wire for a long time, and my personal path as well. So yeah, I'm excited to see how, as the conversation starts to open, how we as a culture start to talk about it,
right?
Because it's hasn't been talked about, like,
for sure.
You don't, like, we're not like, what is happening when you're feeling that creative flow and you feel like there's a channel happening? What does that mean? Does that happen to you, like, you know?
do you those compounds can definitely open you up to frequencies.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like all of a sudden you can see ultraviolet light, like, you know, right. It exists, but yeah. Most times you can't see right now. And they're also incredibly suggestible. So, you know, your trip watching a horror film is going to be a hell of a lot different than creating music. So will you, what does it actually look like for you? Will you take psilocybin going into a practice session and then be like, I'm going to practice for the next 3 hours, or I'm not going to, you know, a lot of writers, yeah. For example, will, like Neil Gaiman, who's a great writer, will just set a timer and say, I can't get up from this chair for 2 hours. Mm. And I can sit here and do nothing, or I can write. But there's a limiting of options,
yeah, totally.
That's allowing him to make it through that creative sludge. Mm. And it's a conversation that I would love to have with you, because I think that there's a misnomer that artists get inspired and then sit down and do their thing.
Right.
Whereas in my experience and what I hear from a lot of people is that sitting down and doing the thing is what makes the inspiration come.
Right.
And there's usually a period of drudgery and wanting to claw your eyes out before that creativity comes.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, as a musician, sometimes just setting up all the microphones and the equipment and getting it all ready becomes like, you know, a chore. And like, you got to be like, oh, let's time it out with the inspiration. But, you know, it's like, it's hard. It's hard to time sometimes. Like, sometimes you'll set it up and the inspiration will come. Sometimes you'll set it up and it won't be there. But it's just the faith that it'll be there eventually. Like, and if you keep doing it, and it gets more and more common. I mean, I would say like, yeah, that's the biggest struggle, is just getting the mics and the gear set up in time to record. It usually works out. Because, you know, after you've been doing it for so long, you have a relationship to just flowing through ideas. and something. A lot of our practices, or the way I record, is that I'll just improvise for a long time until I find something, and then I'll just go back and edit, and I'll just find that little moment. Then I'll loop it, and I'll make something on top of it. And it's a very abstract way of composing. It's not like, oh, I came up with this whole form chord progression, and I memorized it, and no, I'll just like come up with ideas and then piece them together and then have to relearn it.
Right.
Like it's like a very backwards sometimes way of doing it. But I think a lot of producers are making music like that now.
Right. So give me some details, because I'm not a musician. Right. So I want to know about like, what does that recording studio look like? What are the instruments? Yeah. What, just bring me into some details of a recording session for Beats Antique.
Sure.
Dirtwire.
Well, yeah, Beats Antique has a, you know, a lot of gear. We got a big recording studio in Berkeley, California. And but you don't need that. Like I do a lot of my recording at home on a laptop with a little interface and just plugging into my instruments or one mic. And I'll just come up with ideas and flow. A lot of it is playing on top of beats that we've already made. You know, like one of us will make a beat and then I'll just come up with melodies on top of it. Sometimes I'll create a whole piece from scratch, but a lot of it's collaboration. And I think that's where I thrive as a musician, is collaborating with my musical partners, you know, Beats Antique and Dirtwire, and seeing what they're coming up with and be like, oh, I can do this. So that helps a lot, you know. I'm not as much of a productive solo producer, I found, so I really feed off the interaction. But it's really simple. Like, once the mic is set up and the instrument's ready, like, you know, I can come up with something. You know, it might not be used. I have a lot of sketches. They'll never see the day of light, you know?
And yeah. Then...
Light of day.
Day of light. They won't be
day
seen.
Day of light. Light of day.
And then will you, you know, when it's done, you'll put those into folders and then...
Yeah. Then forget about them
forever. Then forget about them forever.
Or sometimes go back and be like, that was cool. And then we develop it. And that was like a sketch from like 3 years ago. That's totally happened before. So every song has its like life, and some of them get busted out in a 2 weeks and you're done. Some of them take like years to finish. It's really wild, like how they all have their different timeline.
Right. How do you deal with burnout and get re-inspired?
It's a good question. I'm in a sort of a writer block burnout right now. Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with just traveling.
You're like, I sit down with Kyle, I get inspired every time.
Yeah, I'm coming back to it. You know, I think it had a lot to do with just needing to reset a routine in my life. I was very ungrounded in traveling a lot. Even though I'm still doing some traveling, I'm situated a little more. I'm taking time for myself. So writer's block is real, you know, and you sort of just got to get through it, like let it go as long as it needs to go. I mean, but as it comes down to it, it's just like sitting down and making music, even though you're like scared of it, and like you're like, this is gonna be the most horrible thing I've ever made. Yeah, I'm intimidated by making music right now, but and then you just get into it. You're like, oh, it's not that scary. It's for a lot of the time for me, it's a head trip. It's a total, like, I don't know if you ever have that with anything in your life. It's a procrastination moment, and then the moment you're actually got the motivation to do it, you're like, oh, okay,
this is fine. Yeah,
this is amazing. I don't know why I was playing that game. And it's like, maybe we do that as it's a self-sabotage thing. It's like wanting rest. who knows what it is, but yeah, it's real.
I don't know who it was who said, we suffer more in imagination than reality.
Mm.
But I often think that I would have a lot of books done if I wrote every time I was thinking about how hard writing is.
Yeah.
But the amount of time that you'll spend just ruminating about what is to come.
Right.
And then almost always you do it and you feel like that was way easier. It, you know, it's like, it's almost like cold plunging. Like, you know, it's good for you. Every time you feel better after you do it, and yet you resist.
Yeah. And I think some of it is like, well, once you create something, it's like a relationship you just started. Right. And I think there's part of it is that hesitation to the commitment of that relationship. You're like, well, I could create something right now, but that's like, what if I create it? I want to finish it. And it's like, it's giving birth in a way. You're like, okay, there's another one I got to take care of. And sometimes it can be daunting to have that responsibility, as opposed to like, oh, it's a good release. That's what I found. So But that, again, that's a headspace to be in around that creation. It can totally just be like, whatever, I just made something. I don't have to do anything with it. It's, or I could.
I identify with that, man. Yeah. I like the relationship analogy. Another one that I think of is like, it's like a contract that you're
right.
signing with a creative endeavor.
Right.
You know, writing a reported piece takes a fucking lot of time if you yeah. want to make it good.
Yeah.
And if I'm going out to tell a story, that initial writing session is usually so hard and so painful, partly because I know how far I have to go to make it good, but I know that there's something there. And I'm like, oh, now I can't abandon this because I know that there's an interesting kernel of there's an interesting message that needs to be told here. And then it's just about going back again and again, session after session. And then there's a point where something will click. And then usually from that point until the final editing, which is like some of my favorite parts, like at the very end, when you're just putting in the little last details, it feels like ice cream. It's like, you're like, oh, this is good. And I know that I'm just like up leveling it a little. And then you finally get to a point where you just abandon, you know, you're like, okay, it needs to come out now. And I know, like, and I wonder, is there a similar process or different process for you in creating a song? Like
yeah.
you sit down for the riff. Mm-hmm. What are the peaks and valleys that you'll go through?
Yeah, there's different there's different waves of inspiration, right? There's like the initial moment of recording it and getting like the fresh ideas out, which is from more of like a subconscious abstract place, which is very fulfilling and like cathartic, and like, oh, that felt good to get that out. Then there's like the monotonous editing element of, oh wow, I have to like go through all these takes and do all this work, which is a whole different side of the brain, but that's more curating. And then once you get that together, there's this whole arrangement brain, which can get very creative again. So you've got now like, ooh, I can do this here, I can bring in this sound effect here, or I can, oh, I'm going to call my friend up and have him record on here. And like, you start to really imagine, you know, you have to can keep imagining what you want it to be. And then you're like, okay, now I got to go mix and do all this. So it can go, I mean, the modern day producer right now is doing a lot of jobs that were split up back in the day. Like, you would come up with a song and an idea, and then the engineer would, you know, mix it for you, because they just knew, they were the ones who knew how to run that. And you were the artist back there that came up with the musical idea. Now those are all fused together. So it's this back and forth of like full creative flow and then like sort of like logical rationale, like, you know, to-do list kind of work on maintenance and like getting it to the finish line, which a lot of people have a hard time with, like just going to those last, getting through that, those hurdles, and tracks will sit on there unfinished for a long time.
What do you think is your biggest weakness as an artist, and what do you think is your biggest strength?
Wow. Yeah. Oh, there's so many. So many weakness. So many. I guess my was my weakness. I would say I'm not as disciplined as I want to be. I mean, but you know, from other people's perspective, they might be like, "Whoa, I don't see that," you know. But and I think that's all it's all perspective. But yeah, I don't practice as much as I want to. You know, I don't like sit down with my instruments as much as I would like to. Hopefully, gonna have create more time for that. So yeah, creating schedule, regimen, you know. I've been very reactive in the past. Just like, I need to get this finished, deadlines. But I do say like deadlines are my strength. If I have a deadline, I usually get it done. Like, it's been pushed a little bit. Like, that's what keeps me going. Like, we need it done by here. I'm like, okay, we're up all night. We make it done. So, I feel like my strengths are in collaboration, in thinking outside the box of putting things together, of bringing interesting creatives together.
What do you think makes a strong collaborator?
I think it's like a spark, an imagination, kismet, like just seeing what is actually already happening. Like Dirtwire is releasing this track called Inner Tribal, which is a collaboration with the Black Lodge singers from, or powwow, traditional Native American singers from Montana, and they're from Montana and Washington, from the Yakima Reservation. And this dancer named Larry Yazzie from Iowa used our music in his TikTok video, and we just saw him use it, and we're like, well, who is this guy dancing to our song? And we found him online, and we DM'd him and contacted him, and we got on the phone, and he came out and performed with us at Lightning in a Bottle recently. And then we were talking, like, wait, we should do a collaboration. Let's, like, create a song for you and, like, a video. And he's like, yeah. And then we started talking about the Black Lodge singers and, and, you know, a lot of that, you know, there's not a lot of Native American powwow music. It's what, you know, traditional drumming and singing music in our scene, you know. And it's been a touchy subject because it's, like, it's a very, you know, there's a lot of dark history there, and so in a way we're using this as an opportunity to bridge that and to be like, hey, like, we honor and love this music and love the spirit of this tradition, and it's been really amazing to work with the Black Lodge singers and see their excitement about it, and, you know, all the money we're raising from it is going towards them. But it was this thing that naturally happened, and Larry, like, really came in as this amazing connector in this, like, sort of the spirit guide in our journey. He, like, showed up and danced to our music, and he's like, let's make a song together. We, like, contacted them, and it just felt really good.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's doesn't seem like you have a lot of fear in trying to collaborate. I think that that's what probably holds a lot of people back from sampling music from other cultures and bringing in different instruments. It's just a level of fear. And that's really cool that you'll just kind of act on a curiosity, which I think is a base emotion for a lot of great collaboration to happen. And then all of a sudden you create something totally new.
Yeah. And trying to do it with as much, like, respect and reverence from the sources that it comes from, you know, and I think that's what we try to do. And and that's why it's working on a lot of these collaborations.
Well, it says a lot about you that this guy trusts you enough to collaborate. I mean, given the sordid history between tribes and white people, like, that says a lot that he's willing to trust you, and you have that whatever it is, you know, to get yeses and get these collaborations in play.
Right. Yeah. And we wouldn't do it any other way. Like, and that's where I feel like a lot of people, that's where it's a touchy subject, you know. It's like getting permission and working in the right way with the traditions is important. And, you know, it's become a way more sensitive, you know, we're in a very highly sensitized place and time and culture. So it's like, yeah, get permission, talk to the people that you want to collaborate from the traditions that you're interested in, go to the places, meet the people. They're amazing. They're excited. You know, they're like, yeah, let's do this. Like, people want to connect, you know?
What do you think are the qualities that allow you to, get yeses from people or make these collaborations happen? Or what would you recommend to, you know, another artist who might be seeking this kind of stuff out?
Go and if you're, like, really interested in, you know, like, Middle Eastern music, go to the Middle East or meet a group in the U.S. that's playing Middle Eastern music, you know, talk to them, like, get involved with them, or the same with, like, African drumming and stuff. I mean, it's easy to sample stuff, you know, everyone can sample anything. I would just highly recommend, if you're really inspired and love it, like, meet the people and the traditions and where it comes from, and you'll get a whole new perspective of, like, the energy of which it comes from, the spirit from which it comes from, the people, and that's just a deeper connection to the music, a deeper connection to this music you'll create, you know? It's just deepening relationships, and I think if you show that love, it's all from a place of love. It's coming from love and curiosity. That's brought, that people want that. If it's come from a place of exploitation and money and, like, greed, people can see that and read that, and that's just there's not much space for that. Or people don't want to have much to do with that, you know.
Hell yeah, man. Well, I think this is a great place to end. Yeah. Any last words to the audience? Anything that you'd like people to do or take from this?
No, I just hope everyone's living their best life and living healthy. And thanks to Mudwater for checking in and supporting. And thanks for all the love for Dirtwire and all the support you guys have been giving us. And check out SR Studios. It's srstudios.org. This is a new project I've launched with some great collaborators, building recording studios around the world. And we're looking for partners and funding. And there's a lot of info on the website, so you can contact us and get involved on any level if you're interested. But yeah, that's the latest over here. And yeah, I'll be taking a break from performing for an indefinite amount of time. And I'm going to keep creating.
Great.
Keep making music with both bands and keep rocking out. Thank you, Mudwater.
I hope you do keep creating, man. And you're on social media as well?
Yeah, I got an Instagram, David Satori.
Cool.
That's sort of what I'm using now.
Perfect. Well, dude, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Kyle.
That's our show. If you enjoyed it, please take 60 seconds and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Just a few stars really does help. You can head over to tierman.substack.com to check out all of my writing, sign up for the newsletter, get podcasts as soon as they drop. It's all over there at tierman.substack.com, or just click the link in the description below. You can send me voice memos at info@kyle.surf. Just bust out your phone. Let me know who you are, where you're listening from. Keep it under 2 minutes and email the voice memo to info@kyle.surf. Thank you so much to RPM Training for sponsoring this podcast. You can head over to rpmtraining.com, type in the code name Kyle T-Man, and get 10% off all at-home functional fitness gear. By using that code, you are supporting this podcast. You are allowing me to prioritize it. So just go over there to rpmtraining.com, type in the code name Kyle T-Man at checkout, and get yourself some at-home fitness gear. Thank you also to Santa Cruz Medicinals. You can go to scmedicinals.com, type in the code name Kyle10, and get 10% off all potent CBD. I'm looking at some of their CBD-infused coconut oil right above my bed right now. I use it for massages. I use it for sore muscles. You can go to scmedicinals.com, type in the code name Kyle10 at checkout, and get 10% off. By supporting them, you are supporting this podcast. Thank you so much for your time and attention. I do not take it for granted. Get out in the water, whatever body of water you are closest to, ocean, lake, river, bathtub. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.